Hey, this is Matt Sorum, Guns N' Roses and Velvet Revolver, and you're listening to the Rock Solid Podcast.
I can't afford to be. This is small town music. This is big town music. He's ahead of his time, you know, but he can't use it. If only he could prove it. Well, tomorrow's just a song away. A song away. A song away.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Rock Solid, the comedy podcast for all things music, both new and classic. I'm Pat Francis, and joining me in the Zoom room to promote his upcoming autobiography entitled Double Talk and Jive, the true rock and roll stories from the drummer of Guns N' Roses, The Cult, and Velvet Revolver. Please welcome one of my favorite drummers, Matt Sorum. How you doing, Matt?
Cool, man. Wow, well, that was a nice intro.
Well, thank you. You deserve it. All those bands, all that great music. Come on.
Thank you. Yeah, it's been a wild ride. As told in the book, Double Talk and Jive.
Now, before we get started, Matt, I want to talk about the really important stuff. I want to say congratulations on the birth of your new daughter.
Do I look tired yet?
You do look a little tired. You have that dad thing, but I didn't know if that was because of your nonstop book promotion or because of the baby.
We had 4 feedings last night. I was on 2 of them. And multiple diapers, but man, I can get those diapers on and off in no time.
you're like a roadie now. You're the baby's roadie.
All this year of training, all this time in the training field, you know, did not prepare me for any of this.
is this your first child?
So far, so good. No one's shown up at my doorstep. And if they did, they'd be old enough to support themselves. So that's cool.
Well, it's very exciting. I'm a father of 2 and they're 16 and 20. So I still remember what it was like to be to have an infant. So again, congratulations.
I know. I feel like she's growing so fast. She's just over 2 months and we're like, oh, we're going to miss when she's this small. And she's almost out of her first phase of clothes, 0 to 3 months, right?
It's crazy, isn't it?
Yeah, we got so many amazing gifts from friends. And it was like, wow, people love babies, man.
They do love babies. People love them. As long as they can just come and visit and then leave, they love them.
Yeah, but I've always heard that you love your own baby more than you love other babies. But I'm like, man, we've got so many people. Like, I'll put up one little picture of my baby, and it just goes mental on so. And you know, I'm like, am I pimping my kid out already? Is this cool? Or, you know, I don't know.
Well, if they're your friends, they're probably excited for you, Matt, because you waited so long to have a baby. So they're probably just excited for you.
They are excited for me. They thought it would never happen, actually, I think, you know.
And so, now it did. So yeah. you prove them wrong.
Yeah.
Matt, let me ask you about the title of the book. It comes from a song written by Izzy Stradlin for Guns N' Roses from the Use Your Illusion 1 album. Why did you choose that title, Double Talk and Jive?
Just sort of rang true with me about sort of coming up through the Hollywood music business, the entertainment business. You know, working with the kind of the backstory of what goes on behind the bands, you know, that Hollywood, hey, I love you, babe, kind of thing, you know?
Right.
And then for a guy that's had sort of hills and valleys in his career, you know, I've seen the ups and downs of that. And, you know, the guy that just told you he loved you, babe, doesn't answer the phone anymore. So Double Talk and Jive was just sort of that, hey, babe, I love you. And understanding, you know, that the book, you know, to where I am now, you know, there was a part of my life that I was pure rock and roll, pure entertainer all the time. The people that were around me for the wrong reasons, probably a lot of times. And and now I just, you know, as you get older, you're like, man, none of that shit really even mattered, except for that it was a lot of fun. And, but those people, most of those people aren't here anymore, alive or dead. And
yeah.
And here I am with my family, and you know,
you came through. You got through.
Yeah.
That's
Kyle just kind of just popped out. And and Izzy was a guy that ended up walking away from the music business as well. Yeah. And we had a really amazing time writing that song in the studio. That's one of the songs that was just pure magic. It went down on the first take. It was a jam. I remember him walking in and me and him messing around with the beat. And he had this like flamenco kind of kind of thing. And then Slash and Duff walked in from going across the street. And there, that's what you hear on the album. I remember thinking that represents the, in the purest form, what that band was about at that time.
Yeah. I mean, I love Izzy. I mean, he's the Keith Richards of Guns N' Roses for sure. I mean, so yeah. Great. Just the songwriting, the guitar playing, not to take away from anyone else, but he just had, I don't know. He just had this dirty rock and roll thing that I love.
Yeah. He was like, you know, he was like the secret weapon.
Right. For sure.
He was the guy that had that secret touch that brought the, you know, and as the band, you know, kept changing, and obviously I came in, you know, things were starting to evolve and change within the band. And I think he was the one last remaining part of that particular original lineup that held that part together, that trueness of the band. If a lot of people don't realize how important he was to those songs and early on the songwriting, especially Appetite for Destruction and then and Use Your Illusion. So
yeah, very, very important in the songwriting. And well, since we might as well, we'll just talk about Guns N' Roses now. I was going to talk about it a little later, but you know, it's the title of the book. So let's get into it a little bit right now. The first time I ever heard Matt Sorum play drums, I'm sitting in a theater watching Terminator 2, Judgment Day, and oh my God, You Could Be Mine starts to play. I think that was a full 2 months before the album was going to drop. Yeah. And I mean, that just came thundering into the theater, and that intro is still exhilarating 30 years on. I mean, just incredible. What an introduction to you in Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, thanks. It was, you know, the song used to just start on the top of the figure. It used to start as a do-do-do-da-do-do-do-da. It was almost kind of a Sex Pistols kind of groove.
Yeah.
And I was a big Terry Bozzio fan. There's this drummer from Missing Persons, and then it's Frank Zappa.
Zappa, right.
You could watch him, and he'd do all this crazy stuff with his kick drum and his toms. And as a joke, on the third take, I went to do that kind of thing.
Uh-huh, and they loved it.
And I went into it, and the band went like, whoa. And in those days, we recorded everything live. There was no like editing or Pro Tools or.
Yeah.
And Mike Klink goes, that's the one. And that, I believe it was third take that, you know, we didn't do a lot of takes on those records because we were very well rehearsed. And we would go in the studio, we were just trying to capture the energy of the moment. And I remember I'd walk in the studio before the fifth take, and I'd say to Slash, I'd say, let's do one more. He goes, you just want to suck the rock and roll right out of it, don't you? And I'd be like, come on, what are you talking about? I'm like, we can play it better, don't you? He's like, no, that feels right. It was for Slash and some of those guys, it was more about the way it felt than it being perfect.
Okay.
Didn't have to be perfect. But it had to have the right intention, the right energy. And I remember when we did You Could Be Mine, and we hit that. And you feel the song, and there was no click tracks, and it speeds up a little bit.
Yeah.
But it creates tension. And you go, wow. And you listen back to a lot of great bands way before us, even the 70s, and you're like, oh, the tempos are moving around, but great.
Right. Yeah, it's great. It doesn't have to be perfect. It's fantastic.
Yeah.
Now, you're the new guy in the band, but it sounded like you fit right in. Like you didn't hesitate to speak up if you had some ideas.
Well, you know, they asked me to join, you know? Mm-hmm. So I was like, well, that was the first part of the equation. It's like, they want me in their band. And, you know, obviously I was in a band that they really respected, the Cult and everything. Yeah. Me and Slash and Duff were especially sort of like the core three guys that were always working together. And Izzy was always a little bit quiet, but he had his songs that he brought, and we would just discuss things as we were rehearsing. And I would say, hey guys, you know, don't you think this is a little long, you know, or something? Why is it 9 minutes, you know, or like, you know, I'm just going to say it. It's long. It's really, you know, and they would go like, whoa, it's fine. Let's just leave it that way. And that's how that band was. We didn't sit down and try to like record some like hit for, you know, three and a half minutes, even though we did have 3 minute songs.
That's right. Yeah.
We lived in the Garden of Eden, and it just was what it was. We didn't go into long any discussions about it needed to be this way because.
Gotcha. So did you realize that you were recording a massively epic collection of songs at that point? Like, did you guys know it was going to be 2 albums and 30 songs? Or did you, Matt Sorum, think they were going to whittle that down to like 12 tunes?
Yes, I did. So we went to this little studio in the Valley called Mates Rehearsal. And we had this board. We used to write all the titles. And we had working titles because Axl hadn't written the lyrics yet. Axl didn't write a lot of the lyrics until some of the songs were recorded.
That's incredible.
And there were songs that had lyrics like Don't Cry. And then he had a really good idea of how he wanted to orchestrate November Rain. And I think he'd had that whole piece of music in his head. And he played that with us. And anyway, when we got in there to record all this stuff, you know, here we are recording 2 songs a day, 3 songs a day. We would go across the street to this place called Crazy Girls, and we would drink and, you know, watch the girls dance and stuff. And then we'd come back and Mike Link would go, you guys just go home, see you tomorrow. You know, we'd be like, you know, but he found us in certain states that worked for the music. We had a song called She Ain't the First, which is kind of like a drunken pirate song.
Yeah, it is.
And we were drunk. We were very drunk. And he said, go out, Sarah, go out in the middle of the room. Let's cut that track now. And it just has the right, it's loose. And we're just like, ah, you know.
Rolling. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. Tried so hard just to get through to you. Your head so far from the realness of truth. Was it just a come on in the dark? Was it meant to last long? I think you want your welcome, honey. I'll just sing you along as I sing you this song.
So anyway, when we finished recording all that music, and I've told this story before, Axl walked in one day and was at a very famous studios, A&M Studios, Studio A, which is now called Henson.
Yes, Henson Studios.
In those days, it was Herb Albert and Jerry Moss.
Yep, A&M.
A&M.
Yeah.
And we were in Studio A, which is made famous by We Are the World, Quincy Jones, in this big room. And Axl, there was a door that was almost like Star Trek, and it was a button. You would go, and it go, whoosh. It was like air door. And Axl came in. I believe he had a couple of pretty girls with him. He walked in. He announced that we were going to put out both albums. We were going to do all the songs.
Okay. Wow.
And he said, We're going to release it all. And we went, what? We're going to put all the music out. But here's how we're going to do it. And he said, I want to do two separate records, but the same album cover in different colors. And Use Your Illusion 1 and Use Your Illusion 2. And he showed us this piece of art that was by a guy named Gustavi out of New York. He was very kind of from the Andy Warhol school. And he had bought this piece of art. And down in the very corner was this thinking man, kind of almost like a Michelangelo kind of thing. And he said, that's the album cover. And it was a very small piece of this massive piece of art. So we somehow figured out how to get that from Gustavi, who was somebody I ended up meeting that guy and licensed it or whatever we did. And then Axel's reason for the two records was that he had worked at Tower Records as a younger guy, and he understood that the records had to be in the bin so he could buy record and go into the bin like the old days when you would I'm going to go over to the section.
Shuffle through, look around.
I'm going to go into section G. There's Guns N' Roses. Okay, cool. Because if it was a double album, it would have been up behind the cash register. It was over $20. They didn't put that stuff in the bin. So that was his first thought process. And then his second thought process is he could probably go back to David Geffen and renegotiate, which I believe they did. And then he had a really big vision about taking the band on the road for this world's longest tour, which we did. And Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 came out at midnight. And we entered the charts at number 2 and 3. And we were like, what the hell? And there was this guy, Garth Brooks, that had shown up out of nowhere. And we're like, who's that? And so we entered at 2 and 3, which really upset us. And
normally people are normally okay with being number 2 or 3, but not you guys. You went the 1 and the 2. Okay.
Yeah. But we didn't know who Garth Brooks was, and neither did anybody had told us about him. So the following week, we were number 1 and 2. Those records went on to do very well in their own right. Some people go, oh, I like 2 better. I like 1 better. But if you look back and you were to take, I was talking to somebody the other day that took the best of the best and made 1 record out of it.
Yeah.
Would it be better, you know, to just make that statement? But that it was what it was. And we became this bigger than life band. We went on to play stadiums. Everything became big and epic.
Yeah.
You know, so
I remember when it came out, Use Your Illusion 2 is my favorite. And here's the reasoning. When those albums came out, I couldn't afford to buy both. So my friend and I went at midnight. He bought number 1. I bought number 2. Just because I heard that one first is probably the reason that I still like that one a little better. But
yeah, and I think You Could Be Mine was on 2, I believe.
Yeah, that it was. And I think that's why I wanted that one. Now, you play on every song except Civil War, which features Steven Adler. And I was always trying to figure out, was that track done and they were satisfied with it, so they didn't need you to give it a whirl?
Yeah, that was the last track they recorded with Steven, so they kept it. And I believe they ended up getting what they wanted out of it. And, you know, it's a cool track on the record. And They added it to the album. I remember even discussing it with the guys. They didn't come to me and go, hey, we never tried to re-record it. You know, there is 2 versions to Knocking on Heaven's Door. I did the first version, the second version.
Okay. The one on the album.
The one they ended up using on Days of Thunder, which was the Tom Cruise film. And that was the first track I ever recorded with Guns N' Roses.
Can't use it anymore.
that was a single day that we went down to the A&M studios, and we had the soundtrack done. It was a David Geffen thing again, I believe.
Yeah.
And someone said, hey, you know, we have a soundtrack for this movie, Days of Thunder, and we're gonna cut Knocking on Heaven's Door. And that's when I went down. And I think maybe it was a way to try me out in the studio to see what it felt like. Mm-hmm. It all worked out. And then, after that, we went back and started on the records. And that was added to the albums as well.
And had you done much studio work at this point, or was this really your big introduction into being in the studio?
No, I came up in the studio.
There we go.
I used to work with, if you look at my resume, it's kind of wacky. I mean, I worked with this producer named Michael Lloyd when I was in my early 20s.
Oh, yeah. He produced Sean Cassidy and stuff like that.
I played with Sean. I played with Linda Carlisle.
There you go.
I worked with Solomon Burke, Gladys Knight and the Pips.
Wow.
I played with a lot of people. That's why I had this sort of diverse style that he could count on, but I liked my backbeat, that's why when people hear me now with Billy Gibbons, they're like, wow, I didn't know you could shuffle like that. I didn't know you had that swing. But my thing,
this.
Oh yeah. I always had to kind of morph my style as I went. Like if you go back and listen to the first Tori Amos album, you wouldn't even recognize me because I'm playing almost like a drum machine.
Last night, caught my boyfriend looking at another slender pair of eyes. Gotta make more money, gotta get the faster than the rest. Knock them off the ladder if they even seem to stand a chance. The big picture.
And I recorded that album with Joe Ciccarelli. We did every drum individually. There was no hi-hats or cymbals. I recorded everything like crazy, weird 80s shit.
That's incredible.
So I did a lot of studio work. So when I got into GNR, I'd already, that's why my drumming, my tuning, the sound of my drums, I was very into it,
One more question. When Axel brings up that you're going to release the two albums together, everyone just accepts his vision. There was no discussion about it.
We just talked and went, wow, what a crazy idea. And okay.
Well, it worked. So that's the thing. It worked.
Yeah.
Then September 1991, you're on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. I assume that was a dream that you had since you were a kid.
Well, yeah, I shot that with the great Herb Ritz in New York City. And that guy was a rock star. I remember being there, and funniest part about that story was Izzy didn't have any clothes. He showed up just just looking like Izzy. And he says to me, hey, Matt, can I borrow one of your jackets? Because I had suitcase with a bunch of clothes and stuff.
Yeah, you were ready. You were ready to be shot.
Yeah, I was always professional like that. And I go, yeah, what about this jacket? And he liked the jacket that he's wearing in the shot. And God bless Izzy, but he was, he was a bit of a guy that maybe didn't take a lot of showers. And I remember he went to hand the jacket back to me and I went, whoa. And I went, just keep it.
that's a present from me to you.
I gave it to him. I always used to say to him, and I've said this to him before, I said, you kind of remind me of the subway in Paris. That's what you smell like.
Well, that's rock and roll, I guess.
Down there. You've ever been down there, but yeah.
And because of Guns N' Roses, you were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Yeah, somehow I got in on that deal. I knew somebody behind the scenes. I don't know.
I think we know why you're in there.
It's like a secret society.
I know.
And now a word from our sponsors.
Hey, I want to give a shout out right now to U-Turn Audio. Now look, a few years back, U-Turn Audio sent me a free turntable, and that got me back into vinyl. But ever since I got that turntable, I've been looking for some speakers that sounded to my ear the way my speakers did with my stereo when I was in high school. And I haven't been able to find those. Now, I've purchased many speakers. Like, I'll order something on Amazon, try them, and they sound like crap, and they go right back to Bezos' house. I actually have his address. I send them right to his house. But U-Turn Audio actually makes speakers. And just this past week, they sent me a pair. The speakers plug right into the turntable, turn on the preamp, turn on the speakers, and you are good to go. These are bookshelf size speakers, ultra low distortion amplification meets classic speaker design, and they are terrific. So look, go to uturnaudio.com, click on their speakers page. They come in black. I have the black. They come in white, and they come in a wood tone. And these things sound great. They're bookshelf size. So try these out, folks. I do not think you'll be disappointed.
Now back to the show.
You were born in Southern California, which is, you know, usually everyone comes here from somewhere else. And you've been here the whole time.
Yeah, I'm a native, which is so weird because sometimes you meet a native and you're like, really, you're from here?
Right. No one can believe it.
Yeah, because Hollywood was like this melting pot, you know, for all these characters from all over the place. Slash is a native. He grew up in Hollywood. Duff came from Seattle. Axel came from Indiana. Same way. Right. Dizzy Reed, I can't remember where the hell he was from. East Coast or something. But yeah, you know, I spent some of my formative years, as I talk about in the book, kind of sneaking out of Orange County and heading up to Hollywood in the early 70s and mid 70s and getting that taste of the big city and rock and roll. And as soon as I got out of high school, I was like, you know, only 60 miles north, but
yeah,
was far enough away in those days. It felt a long ways away.
Right.
And you had to be there to be there.
Yeah. You had to be there if you wanted to be in this business, in the music business.
You had to be in it. You know, it wouldn't be any different if you came from Philadelphia or Orange County.
Mm.
And you had to live there, be in the middle of it. That's what I did.
And when did you start playing drums? What age?
Right after I saw the Beatles. That was it. I was like 5 years old. And I got that small little drum set, Sears drum set, and started banging away on that thing. And then that was like a kid's kit, you know. My brothers, I had two older brothers, and they were terrorizing me all the time. They hated it. And I just stayed passionate about it. I remember my mom got me this little blue sparkle St. George when I was about 9. And then I was taking music classes in school. My mother was a music teacher. Mm-hmm. And just started, that was it. And had a little band, elementary school band. We used to play I had a band called Liquid Earth. We all wore Hawaiian shirts. And played like Crosby, Stills, and Nash. I remember I sang lead and from the drum kit. Because I remember there was this band called Rare Earth. And they said, the drummer can't sing. I said, Rare Earth's drummer sings lead. And I sing and play at the same time.
Ringo would sing?
Yeah. So I'm like, look at the guy in Rare Earth. He's up front too. And so I sang Helpless in the fifth grade talent show.
So you knew what you wanted.
Hey, Helpless. Hey, Helpless.
So you knew what you wanted to do from 5 years old. And I assume since your mom taught music that she was on board with it.
No. I think it was more of a nervousness about, you know, me escaping into Hollywood, and maybe that particular time, you know, in the 70s, the pot and the drugs and everything that kind of went with music. You know, mm-hmm. My favorite drummers were John Bonham and Keith Moon, right? They both died of alcoholism. And, you know,
right. Those are the guys you're worshiping, your mom might have a little trepidation.
They were heroes of mine. Yeah. And So I think she was more nervous for me. So she didn't encourage it. And she was sort of like, you know, I used to work in high school. I was working as a chef. I would cook omelets at this omelet place. And my mom was like, you should be a chef. I'm going to send you to. I'm like, anything but being a drummer in a band.
Wow. Yeah.
So when they, when my stepfather and my mom took off, she retired from teaching and he did as well. They got a boat and sold the family house. So I was on my own at 17. And she said, you can either come with us or you're on your own. And at that point, I moved in with a bunch of guys in a band in Newport Beach. And then I ended up to Hollywood not long after that. But yeah.
Yeah. And but once the success came, then she was all on board, I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't think she understood it at first. I remember the first time I called her and said, I joined this band called The Cult. And she, that kind of scared her. It was like, The Cult? It's like, what's that? But once she started, people started telling her, you know, your son's in Guns N' Roses? Like, then it clicked.
And then when she sees, picks up the Rolling Stone magazine, maybe mother, then she gets it.
I got five copies from my mother. Was it five or 10? Was that Dr.
In that? Yeah. What is that's a Dr. Hook song. I forget how many copies.
I got five copies from my mother. On the cover of the Rolling Stone. Yeah.
Now, Matt, you're giving us, you're entertaining us with a little bit of your singing today. I do want to tell people that Matt Sorum does have two solo albums, 2004 Hollywood Zen and 2014 Stratosphere. Yeah. And I got to mention the song The Sea on Stratosphere. I love it. Oh, such a great tune.
The time won't let me go. I'm lost in the undertow. Let the water wash away my shame as the sea calls out my name. Waves break upon my lonely soul. They bring me to the I find a raft where it teaches me to be one with the sea.
When I made that record, I was going through this whole like soul searching era where I was, you know, cleaned up, and I wrote that song, The Sea, about sort of the water as this metaphor for a cleansing, a great cleansing, if you will. And it meant a lot to me metaphorically with spirituality, which I like to say I'm a spiritual guy. I'm a very grateful guy. But that took a lot of work. And then around that time of making that record, I was really in that, you know, so you can hear that on the album.
And what type of a guy were you? Because you're very soft-spoken. You're very focused. What kind of a guy were you when you were in Guns N' Roses and you guys are 6 months into a Use Your Illusion tour? What kind of a guy is Matt Sorum?
Exactly like I thought I was supposed to be.
Okay, gotcha.
I really felt that way. I felt like the old expression, I got to wave the flag for rock and roll. I felt responsible. I felt like I have to enjoy every moment of this. I can't miss anything. I have to do whatever the band's doing, which is the drinking and the drugging and the scallywagging and everything else that went into the energy of that particular unit. And I used to describe it much as being on a pirate ship.
Yeah.
It was like, we are pirates and we play rock and roll. And it felt right. It just, I felt I had to dedicate myself to that particular attitude. And that's what we did, you know.
You guys were living it.
We were 24/7. And I used to joke. I used to say, people go, well, do you go out every night? You party every night? I go, well, yeah, because I'm in a different town and it's their party and we're just there. Right. And I don't want to miss anything. And I said, I used to joke and say, well, it'll be great for the book.
Yeah.
And I'd have some crazy story and, you know, I'd write it. I never wrote things down. I just remembered everything. People go, how do you remember everything? I don't know. I'm like Rain Man or something.
Well, Keith Richards' book is over 500 pages long. I have no idea how that guy remembered stuff, but he did too. So,
yeah.
Now,
had a lot more life than me.
Now, I only have one more Guns N' Roses question because there's so much other stuff that I want to talk to you about today. But here's my number one question about Guns N' Roses that I don't understand myself as a music fan. Why aren't you in Guns N' Roses right now?
Oh, I don't know. As John Paul Jones would say, maybe they lost my phone number.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's a different time. It's mm-hmm. It's 30 years later. Axel's band, he's very happy with his band. Axel's always been a really loyal guy. I look back at Axel, go, you know what? He was a loyal guy.
Mm-hmm.
You believed in him, he believed in you. And you know, he had those guys that were with him, and then Slash and Duff rejoined and off they went. And that's basically how it went down.
Yeah. When Slash and Duff came back, I was I thought Matt would be back too, but okay. Yeah. All right. Well,
yeah.
The newest thing you're
part of is you're making babies, man.
I'm holding up right now this new Billy Gibbons album, Hardware. You co-produced it.
Yeah.
I think you co-wrote, 12 of the 14 songs or 10 of the 12 songs, and you play on the whole thing. This is a great album. So people, go buy Billy Gibbons Hardware, Billy F.
Just the most fun I've had making music in so long. Cause that guy, Billy Gibbons, is cool.
He is cool. He's cool. There's no other way to say it.
So the pandemic hits, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Billy, I call him Billy because I'm really concerned about him. And obviously we know he just lost his bandmate, Dusty.
Yeah.
And absolute travesty, is so horrible about the years they spent together. But when the pandemic hit, I was like calling Billy every day going, are you okay? He'd be like, well, not really. I'm not in a tour bus. Because think about it. He's been on the road for 52 years.
52 years. And up until Dusty passed, just those three guys.
That's right.
Yeah.
And so I call Billy. I go, we're going to make a record. He goes, what? I go, come out to the desert. I got the place. So we went up to this cool studio called Escape above Pioneer Town in Joshua Tree area. And I said, we're going to live there and we're going to make music and you're going to cook breakfast.
So Matt, I just want to stop you. I just to clarify, this new Hardware album, this is your idea. This is you getting Billy out of his house to play rock and roll. This you started this ball rolling on this particular album.
I'll lay claim to that. Yeah. So okay, basically,
cool. I'll give it to you.
The title of the record is Hardware. Joe Hardy passed away about a year prior to me talking to Billy about making this record.
And he's the guy who produced, he produced the last two Billy albums.
Yes, and ZZ Top back to 1980. So Joe Hardy was Billy's collaborator, musical collaborator on everything ZZ Top to Billy Gibbons solo.
Okay.
And me and Billy are close friends. We speak almost daily now, and it's like, it's a trip, but I love the guy. And anyway, he opened up to me about what that meant, losing Joe, not only as a friend, but as this musical counterpart. Mm-hmm. So he was nervous about taking the next dive into the studio. So I have this really cool studio in LA called Track Studios, which is now gone and moved to the desert. We're building a new studio there. I said, come over. We're going to try a couple of things. He goes, well, I got this one tune. It kind of sounds like a cross between Foxy Lady and Purple A's. I said, yeah, those songs always sounded a little bit alike. He says, but I got this song. And I'm like, cool, that sounds good. So we went in there and tracked it with my engineer, Chad Slozer, who ended up getting co-production on the record. And Billy had a blast.
And what was that song called, Matt?
That's one, SLMMBB. What is it? Fucking?
Yeah, I got it. I got it. SGLMBBR. What does that stand for?
Oh, you have to ask him.
All right.
Some girls like my big bad ride.
All right.
Yeah. Something like that. So anyway, we tracked that and he had a blast and he called me up because I really enjoyed that. That Chad, he's a whippersnapper. And so I said, okay, let's take that and go to the desert. We brought another good buddy of Billy's named Mike Florentino, comes from Nashville. And we hunkered down up there and we lived in this cabin, recorded the whole album in a garage. And if you watch the West Coast Junkie video, that garage is where we recorded the record.
That's the, because I just thought that was like some old place you stumbled upon and you just set the cameras up and recorded there, but that's the place.
That's it. We had the best time and he would wake up in the morning and make us a Mexican breakfast. And he'd say, I got to make a drive. I'm going to go down to the Walmart and I'll be back in 2 hours. And every day we would record something and it was so much fun. And we did that last summer and we put it out this year. Did four videos for like nothing. I got a buddy of mine to shoot them with one camera. People go, well, that's a really low budget video. And I go, well, it is. We made them for $1,000.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. What do you want?
Yeah. Like,
man, guys, you know, out in the desert these playing.
These days, it's not like November Rain when we had $1 million video budget.
No.
You know, no. I said, people go, well, that Billy Gibbons video looks kind of low budget. I go, it was like the hummus dip on the November Rain video shoot. You know what I mean? I'm serious. I'm like,
so. Well, I'm glad you're working with Billy because, you know, as some of our veteran artists get older, the music's keeping them young, the music's keeping them alive. So you're doing good.
Well, I mean, I feel like it's a pretty stand-up rock album for Billy because
it is.
He went off onto a Cuban thing, and then the last record was more bluesy, And then when he put me at the helm with Mike and Chad, I was like, let's rock. And then we threw down some surf music and we just lyrically got a little bit deeper. Like I wrote the lyrics for Vagabond Man. I wrote that about Billy.
On the road a million miles and everything in between. I've seen so many faces and the pleasure that they bring. Always left without a warning. Never look back in the mirror. You know I lost some good ones. Always left them with a tear. Cause I've been a liar and a thief, a gambler and a cheat. Life the best I can, like a vagabond, a vagabond man.
And we all collaborated on that, and he was like, well, I don't know about that last verse, Matt. The Santa Fe has left the station is better. I'm like, I like that.
All right.
So we would talk about that, but it's really easy to write lyrics for Billy Gibbons because he's the epitome of, you know, the desert, cactus, hot rods.
Yeah.
You know, dust. You know, and when we did Desert High, I don't know if you've heard that spoken word piece.
Yeah.
We wrote everything that kind of, we were in the surrounding of these desert creatures and rattlesnakes. And of course we were very close to the Joshua Tree Inn where Graham Parsons passed away. And we started talking about that. And I'm like, Graham Parsons died down right down the street at room 8 at Joshua Tree Inn. And he used to bring Keith Richards out here. And Billy said, he did? I said, yeah. And Donovan, the folk singer, and they all came here to feel the energy of the desert. So we started getting in these conversations. And that turned into Desert High.
Yeah. The desert dust, it fills your eyes. The rattlesnake shake takes you by surprise. The coyotes sing in the calm of night. The cactus water goes down like fire. The city of angels ain't too far from here. And when I need some sin, it's always near. The Caliente warms my bones. And the valley of death is a skeleton's home. The desert toad takes me for a ride. The lizard king's always by my side. The hawk and the eagle just want to fly.
So it was great. It was now, old school, living together, being with each other, no distractions to write a cool album. And in my opinion, I love the record.
It's a great record. And I've been telling tons of people on this show and just friends in general to pick up this album.
Thank you.
What's it like for you working with, you know, you grew up as a kid, you're probably a ZZ Top fan. You certainly knew of them, even if you weren't a fan. And now this guy's your friend and you're working with him. That's got to be kind of cool.
Yeah. It's crazy though. My life's been crazy. And, I'm just really honored that he asked me to be the drummer. Like he could have any drummer in the world he wants, you know, and then I think he respects me as a musician more than just a drummer, I guess, and a songwriter and, you know, and the process, he had to learn to trust me more. Cause like I said, he had this Joe Hardy guy.
Yeah.
Well, I was the guy that he knew long enough to be able to trust to start this new phase and process of his life. And, he's got an energy of a 20-year-old, you know, and when Dusty passed and he called me and said, they're going to keep going. I said, well, what else are you going to do? That's what you do, Billy. You play guitar, you entertain people. I would say there's nobody else that I can really remember, with the exception of maybe Lemmy and a guy like Slash, that are just wake up in the morning and they're those guys and they're put on this earth to entertain. They just want to travel and play guitar. And that's it.
And then it's not work. It's just fun.
Yeah. I think the part that's the scariest for them is when they're sitting still or they're at home and they're, you know, on their couch trying to watch TV. Like, it doesn't work for them. Like, no. For me, I can do both. I'm happy to be at home. But I know these guys, and I know Billy well enough to know that he's the happiest and most content when he's up on stage playing.
Yeah, he needs that. All right, let's talk about your first project after Guns N' Roses, 1996, Neurotic Outsiders.
Yeah.
Produced by Jerry Harrison of the Talking Heads.
Yeah.
I mean, people call it a super group because we know all the players from other big bands. John Taylor from Duran Duran, Duff from Guns N' Roses, Steve Jones from the Sex Pistols. And then it's released on Madonna's Maverick record label. I mean,
yeah,
this has everything going for it. Great players, great songs, great producer, great label. And this just didn't do what I had hoped it would do because I love this record so much.
No, thanks. Well, that band came together by mistake. We were an accident. We got together for a benefit at the old Johnny Depp Viper Room on Sunset. And we had so much fun that we ended up making a band out of it. I remember John Taylor calling me up going, let's do this every week. We started going down there. We did a residency every Monday night at the Viper Room. Before we knew, we had a line around the block. And there was this young A&R guy who used to stand in the front row every night. His name was Guy O'Siri. And Guy just signed up with Freddie DeMann over at Maverick to find bands to sign. He had just signed Alanis Morissette, which that record took off. And
yeah, gigantic.
Crazy. And a band called Candlebox. And he offered us a record deal backstage one night. And we were just like, what? You know, we weren't even, let me shut this off. Sorry. We weren't even really a band, and we were playing mostly like Pistols covers.
Yeah.
And, you know, whatever, punk stuff and Iggy Pop. And all these people came up every week. Iggy sang with us, Brian Setzer, Billy Idol. So we took this record deal, made this record, went up to Record Plant Sausalito and recorded the album. And then Axel called me and Duff back to work, our day job. Pistols got back together on 40 years.
Yeah.
John Taylor still had Duran Duran. So we did some short touring, didn't do a lot of touring around those records, but still to this day, I'll have people come up to me going, I love those records.
Yeah. It's great. I wish it's hard to find too. I wish someone would reissue this. Cause it's such a great record.
It got reissued by a company that made CDs, through Rhino, I believe. And I believe that there's a good possibility that we could re-release it on vinyl. I'd like to do that because I love vinyl. I have my vinyl site I'm involved in called Experience Vinyl.
Cool.
Yeah.
All right. Your next major band after Guns N' Roses, I'm talking major because you guys did more than one album. You had the debut went double platinum, and I'm talking about, of course, Velvet Revolver.
Hands are shaking, got your finger on the trigger, jeans are shaking, painting on the finger. wash it down. My brother hungers and they live on the ground.
Ain't nobody melting while this water's on the pine. It's the alien invasion, it's a coming of crime.
All this sailor and our heroes and this consequential angel on a mother with the devil gonna live or the fight. Don't look at me now, fail too fast, your wings won't hold. Don't look at me now, fail too fast, your wings won't hold.
So it's you and Slash and Duff, Dave Kushner, and then you get Scott Weiland because he's not having a great time with Stone Temple Pilots, or maybe they're not having a great time with him, whatever the reason is. And you guys make a kick-ass album. It's so good.
Thanks.
My one question, though, as an outsider, not in the music industry, is Axl seems to me like he could be difficult to work with. But talking with you earlier, it didn't sound like that from the what we've been talking about so far. And Scott Weiland seems like he might be difficult to work with at times too. So did you guys have any trepidation going from Axl to working with Scott?
Well, if you watch the documentary, it's a documentary called The Rise of Velvet Revolver. It's on VH1. I believe you can find it on YouTube.
Okay.
We spent about a year trying to find a singer. And We auditioned all these guys, and we did audition a girl too named Beth Hart.
Oh, I know Beth. Yeah, she's fantastic.
Yeah, and it's really funny because Mike Klink brought her down and didn't tell Slash it was a girl, and she came in and just blew our brains out with her voice. And we didn't go with Beth, obviously. So we were really struggling to find somebody that felt right and had everything that we're used to with Axl, you know, that swagger, that rebellion, that whole thing that we liked as a front man.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the book, I talk about Scott showing up late for the first big, you know, get this movie score, and he's gone, and he's an hour late, and it's absolute chaos, and we're all nervous. And he comes in and just kills it. We get this massive deal for this film called The Hulk, and the next thing we know, we've got a three record companies after us, and we're getting flown to New York to meet with Clive Davis and Sylvia Roan. And I'm like, oh shit.
The song you're talking about is Set Me Free, which was on the, in the movie, in Ang Lee's Hulk movie.
Yeah, which was one of my first guitar riffs that I wrote for Velvet Revolver, and yeah. I talk about it in the book. And I had this riff, and I remember being so nervous to play it for Slash. And I go, da na 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 na, I have the thing, and he's like, it's cool, you know. And then we have all these different versions of singers singing on it, right? Yeah. And then Scott's came. We're like, I turn around to the band, I go, there it is. There's your guy.
He's the one.
And obviously, it started with a bumpy start. We had a bumpy start. You know, Scott was somebody we had to work with and get him. We were all really in good shape then. We got ourselves cleaned up a lot. Everyone was, you know, I mean, man, I was eating egg whites and chicken breasts I was skinny as a rail. I was better than I ever looked in Guns N' Roses because I was kind of bloated in those days. Too much alcohol. But we had this great run. And, you know, we did really well on that first record. And then some of the demons reappeared for all of us. We had some issues everyone was doing too much again. And the engine got big and the machine got, you know, weird.
Yeah.
And I remember the feeling of when I felt it coming, like things were, the train was going off the tracks. I'm like, oh, and the energy was changing, the vibe was changing. And, you know, we were on email now. It was like the end of rock and roll fucking email. Well, yeah, we were emailing, like, you know, to each other. We couldn't speak to each other.
I see what you're saying. Okay. You know, you guys weren't speaking in person.
We'd be in a room. We'd be in a room together and someone would bring a fax.
Yeah.
And we'd be, hey, you guys got to check out this deal. And here it is. We go, what do you think? You go, yeah, cool. Let's do it. And then all of a sudden we're on email. No. Yes. No. I'm like, we got, it got, everyone got pulled apart again. And
yeah.
Shit got weird. So that yep. band started to kind of frazzle, you know, unfortunately. Yep. It was hard for me because I was really like, we need to stick together, you guys. This is great. And we just couldn't figure it out.
That was a question I was going to ask you when Velvet Revolver came over. Did you kind of feel like that was going to be your forever band? Did you think, oh, this is it?
I was hoping so. Yeah. Because yeah. I had a big house in the Hollywood Hills with a pool.
Yeah.
I bought two sports cars. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Well, when you have stuff, you want to keep your stuff when you have stuff for sure.
Well, you know, you get the lifestyle isn't that bad. I always were like, well, this is a pretty cool job. I like this job.
Yeah.
I'm going, I'm making records. I'm touring. I'm staying in nice hotels, playing cool shows. And somehow, sometimes us musician guys just like to screw it up. I just don't know why that is, but
yeah,
it was like, I always say to people, it was lightning in a bottle.
Yeah.
And it was a great time. We had a great run and Scott was fucking awesome. Everyone was great. It was a different energy than GNR.
Yeah.
It had a different intensity about it.
And the second album's great too. Libertad's great. She builds quick machines and that ELO cover, whose idea was that to cover Can't Get It Out of My Head?
Brendan O'Brien.
Pretty cool.
And I remember we did it and Brendan and me cut that. Brendan played acoustic on that because he had this real great rhythm sense, very talented guy.
Yeah.
And I remember we took it to New York to play it for Clive Davis. And Clive says, we need to put that out as a single.
Wow.
And he goes, that will cross over. He used to love to say crossover. He said that about Fall to Pieces. He's like, you guys want to cross this over? Because Clive didn't like the video that we did for Velvet Revolver's Fall to Pieces. It was a little too dirty for him. Mm-hmm. He wanted to make it more mainstream.
It's been a long year since you've been gone. I've been alone here, I've grown old. Fall to Pieces.
Kept saying, I want you guys to cross over, meaning go really big.
Yeah.
Like, you know, boom,
Now, when you would hear that term back in 2004, crossover, was that a negative thing for you guys to hear?
Yeah. Yeah. We were a rock and roll band. We didn't want to be on K-Earth. Yeah. You know, we didn't give a shit. But, you know, how many records do you want to sell? He'd say.
Right.
And I was like, but we were very true to like keeping the integrity of where we came from.
Yeah.
So we fought to keep the video the way it was. And I look back at it and there's the scene where Scott's shooting up and he's in the bathroom. And it's like, was it necessary? Maybe not. I don't know. I mean, do we want to be personify something that we really weren't? We were that band. And it was the way it was done. And he believed in that. And to this day, I just spent some time with Clive. He was out in the desert down the street from me and we spoke about it and had a really good talk about it. And of course he wanted to see the band stay. He was very proud of that moment for his career because no one thought he could sign a rock band like us and be as successful as he was with it. And I remember when we got the Grammy, I saw Clive and I went, "We got the Grammy." I was like, "Clive got the Grammy." Clive knew people. I always used to say, Clive has like the bat phone. Remember the bat phone?
And the red phone. Like, push one button.
Like the phone would blink and they would pick it up. He'd go, "Give him the Grammy." Right? It's like, it's Clive.
All right, Matt, we're going to wrap it up. I do want to mention one other song that you play on that I just love. It's from a Sammy Hagar album. It's you, Sammy, Billy Duffy, and Michael Anthony. And I just love this song, Loud. I love it. I saw that video for that song. I was completely in love with it. And you guys looked so cool together. So I just want to give that like a quick mention. King. Yeah. Oh, so great.
Sammy sent me that. He goes, "What do you think?" I go, "Loud like a hurricane? Really?" He goes, "Get Billy Duffy. I want to make it like the Cult." And I remember we all flew up to Marin because Sammy lives up in Marin.
Right,
me,
right.
Anthony and Billy. And we went to Sammy's studio and recorded that. And we made the video somewhere in the valley.
So cool.
Yeah.
All right. Let's do some promotion. First of all, you can follow Matt on Twitter and Instagram at Matt Sorum, and his website is mattsorum.com. Pretty simple. You can pre-order this book right now, pretty much everywhere. Again, Devil Talk and Jive, True Rock and Roll Stories from the Drummer of Guns N' Roses, The Cult, and Velvet Revolver. Matt, one more thing I need from you before we go. I always ask my guests to pick a playout song. So you got to pick one song from your entire career. It's going to be the playout song today. I know, tough.
Let's just go Double Talk and Jive.
Double Talk and Jive is the name of the book, and it's the song that you picked. So that's what we'll do. Matt, easy. Thank you so much for doing this. I really enjoyed talking to you. I really enjoyed hearing your stories, and I can't wait to get into this book and hear these stories in more detail. So everyone, buy this book. It'll be your close out the summer, start the fall, reading some rock and roll tales. Matt, again, congratulations on your daughter and good luck with the book. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye.
your money, motherfucker, cause I got no more patience. Double fucking lager. No more patience.